So this is just another discussion panel. So we thought maybe we would start by calling for questions on divine attributes, since that is the theme of the conference. And there may be a nagging divine attribute, a divine attribute that's kind of in the back of your mind that you just haven't quite been able to sort out, and you really want someone on this panel to tell you about that. So do we have any questions about divine attributes? And then we can move from there.
If not,
and then, you know, of course, really anything that came up in the talks or in the conference are fair game, but let's privilege divine attributes to begin. Yeah.
Yeah, it's about goodness, and the God's infinite goodness allows evil and brings good out of it. So correct me or say that it's right, but to think this through a little bit. So given that God is absolutely sovereign, perfectly good, and all-knowing, wouldn't that mean then that all instances of physical and moral evil are integral to the accomplishment of the divine plan?
That's a big one. Who brought this up
in?
Well, I'm afraid I did.
Yeah. That's right.
So, yeah, that's a really good question. I think it's really important. If I remember right, Thomas insists that evil can only pertains to divine plan per accidens. It does pertain to it. It falls under the divine plan. So he's ordering evil to good. That's what he says in that text. But it's not, he deliberately rejects the idea that it's integral. His plan is for the good, right? And the good that he has in view, sometimes some goods even require evil, right? Like the patience of the martyrs, right? Then he gives that example, right? Others don't absolutely require it, but nevertheless, they in the plan they presuppose it somehow. Okay, but he insists that it's only incident, it's only indirect, it's per accidens that it falls under the divine plan. It's never for its own sake, obviously, right? The evil, and it's not as something that, absolutely speaking, is necessary. Or that God wants. Let's put it that way. It's not something that God wants. Right? He permits it. That's kind of another way of saying the same thing, maybe. He only permits it. He doesn't aim at it. Right?
If I can, not being really an expert on this, but having been obliged to teach some of this material and thinking about it, and I'd love to be corrected by the wiser minds in the room. But on this point, an important element of Aquinas' account is that evil doesn't, properly speaking, have a per se cause. So when you think about God's universal causality, God does cause all that is, and the thing is, evil is not. So it gets very dark for us, because it seems to us like evil is, but technically speaking, you know, what is the reality, and then there's some privation that, in a sense, should be there, that isn't there. But God's not causing the privation. He's permitting the privation. So then you say, well, where does the privation come from? Where does not... I mean, in a certain sense, you're back to the absurdity of asking, what is non-being? And, of course, the answer is, it isn't. So it's our minds kind of run up against the wall there, and it's partly because of the problem of, or the fact that evil is a privation. But maybe another thing to add is that God's plan somehow, I mean, we could say, well, why wouldn't it be better if there just was no evil at all in the system? No privation, he just permitted no privation. And we don't really know why it's better that there's not no privation. Because to us it seems like it would be better. But we also should acknowledge that our minds are not God's mind, so we can't really see in the end how it's all going to work out, and perhaps one day we will see it and say, oh, okay, yeah, this was much better, in fact. But that also remains fundamentally obscure to us. Dr. Gorman, do you have something to add on this?
Yeah.
Because I would expect you would have wisdom on this.
May I add something?
Yeah. Yeah.
Now, I've been accused of reading too much Brian Davies, on this particular issue. But I think we have to be a little careful with permit, though, because it's not permit like I might permit my kids to run amok, right, and say, well, I'm not doing it. They're just going and doing their thing. It's more like this, you know, where, I could give Father train fare back to the city.
Thank you.
Yeah, but I don't, right? Oh. So I permit, you know, in that sense, I permit him to miss the train, right? But it's not just, I said, go do what you will. I actually, you know, decided how much money I would or wouldn't give you, and then thereby this privation came about. Do you see what I mean? So I think when we say permission, a lot of times we make it sound like God just lets reality run on its own, and it's the universe's fault that it goes amok. We can't quite say that, right? Because it's, you know, how well the universe does in part is how much good God gives it.
That's true,
right? You know, so it's like, well, Jim permitted Father to miss the train because he only gave him $8 instead of 16. That's true, right? But it's not like I wasn't involved in it, and it's not like I couldn't have done better for it if I wanted to, right? Do you see that? You know, so I always want to be not quite so quick to play in the privation card to get God off the hook here, right? Do you see that?
Well, I think the point is that, concede that, yeah. Yes, that's right.
Yeah.
But in the end, where does what causes the evil? Well, it's only per accidens caused, and
right.
It's by creatures.
Right.
So God has designed a system where there's going to be evil.
Right.
He doesn't cause the evil, but he clearly causes the system, and he worked it out this way that evil would arise in the system,
right.
which he envisioned and created the system where that will arise, even though he doesn't cause it,
right.
And that is very mysterious to us.
Right.
And Aquinas' claim, I think, it's not just Aquinas; Augustine would say this too, and many others, is well, here you're up against the kind of mystery of divine predilection, like why does God create what he creates and why doesn't he make it?
Sure.
Why doesn't he do it differently? Mm-hmm. And we can't answer that question.
Right. Yeah, I just want to make sure that permission, using the concept of permission, doesn't provide some kind of moral justification. It shows that by itself, not by itself, right?
And often
people use it almost that way.
From here, we could jump into a very big debate over Molinism and physical premotion and the De Auxiliis controversy. I mean, that's exactly where all of this leads. But that's not the subject of our conference, so maybe we should move to another.
Can we hear what Michael?
Michael,
I want
to
throw out a couple things related to this. So one is that, just sort of even beyond what you were saying, Aquinas actually has this sort of detailed thing worked out where, so Aquinas says that God operates in every operator, right? So like when it's not like God made the sun and now it shines on its own, right? God causes it to shine now. So then it sounds like then God has to cause me to sin. And so what he says is he doesn't cause... I forget how he puts it. He like doesn't cause the sin, but he causes the act of sin.
It's the act of sin, yeah.
He finds a way of slicing the bread extremely thin there. Now, it may work.
Now, we're getting
into
this.
I'm just saying it's not... It kind of puts an edge on Dr. Madden's point. It's not just like, well, he lets us do it. He actually is causally upstream of that bad act that I do, but not insofar as it's bad. So it's a tricky thing. Aquinas, if I understand correctly, holds that there's no best world that God could have created, right? Because no matter what he does, he could have done something better. So the explanation of why he has a world with evil, and I almost said permits evil, what the heck? It's not because he thereby gets the best world, because there's no such thing. But it still might be true that if he didn't permit evil, the total world would be worse. Right? Maybe that all the worlds with no evil are worse than the worlds with at least some evil. Or something like that.
Yeah. Well, Brother Agnes.
Yeah, this question is a little bit about the intersection between theology and philosophy. I'm particularly wondering about the attribute of God's knowledge. There's a quote from St. Anselm that Aquinas frequently uses, that God the Father speaking himself in the Word speaks every creature, so that in the procession of the Word, all creatures are expressed in some way. So the expression of all creatures, of course, insofar as they all pertain to God's knowledge, is reduced to his essential attribute of knowledge. But through that same action of speaking all creatures, he speaks the Word. So it's like it's one action by which God, the Word proceeds, and all creatures. So can you explain a little bit how, whether the attribute of God's knowledge as manifested in creation is reduced to the divine essence or to the Word?
Wait, so I followed you until the question part. So say more about the question, how what you I said up until the question leads to the question. Does that make sense?
Sure, yeah. The fact that God the Father speaking himself speaks the Word, so that's why the Word is the wisdom of the Father, right? And so God's knowledge pertains to the Word. It's attributed, it's appropriate to him. But through that same action of speaking the Word, at least according to Aquinas' gloss on that text from Anselm, he speaks every creature. So there's all, speaking every creature, that he creates all things. So God creates all things by his wisdom. So then it seems that God, by God's wisdom, he both expresses the Word proceeds by wisdom, and also all creatures proceed by wisdom, created by wisdom. So then there seems to be a problem that wisdom is both a personal attribute of God as far as it pertains to the Son, who is wisdom, and also an essential attribute as far as all creatures proceed by wisdom. So which one is it? Is it personal or is it essential?
Why do we have to choose? Is this one?
I don't know if it is. It looks like maybe it turned off, went on standby.
But why the either or?
Well, one point, but that could be the answer. That is God an exemplar cause of creatures both as Word and as divine essence? Because Aquinas seems to say that God's exemplarity is only with regards to his essence, that it's all the things that you find in creatures are only found in the divine attributes and not in particular persons. But at the same time, the Word is a kind of exemplar cause too, in a way. So I'm wondering, how do you reconcile the exemplarity of the Word and the exemplarity of divine essence?
Can I offer an answer, which I know because I did my doctoral work under Father Gilles Emery, and I wrote something like that in my, in one of my chapters, and he, had to call me in and give me this long lecture about not speaking improperly. Something like that. I don't remember who was on exactly this point, but it was, he did that, he had to do that often, obviously. So I think he would say that the Word is God's wisdom. Word is the proper name. Wisdom is so it's proper to the Word to be wisdom proceeding, but not just to be wisdom in general. So then you have wisdom which is of all three persons are essentially wise, and then you can speak about the Word as the wisdom of the Father. Okay, that's clear that you're talking about the wisdom as proceeding. But if you just say wisdom without adding proceeding, you're just making an appropriation. So then when Aquinas is talking about how God makes all things through his Word, it's not that the Word is an instrument of the Father in doing those things, but that all that the Father speaks, the Son is the sort of exemplar for creation, insofar as he is wisdom proceeding. So everything that is created pre-exists in a way in the one Word of God. But there when you say yes, okay, the Word which proceeds from the Father, you have a Trinitarian notion, but otherwise that's also, of course, everything in the Word is also in the Father, except for the fact that he's from the Father. So, does that answer your question?
To some extent, yeah. So basically, okay, yeah.
Yeah.
Another question on knowledge. This is just with respect to the explanation that Aquinas gives in question 14, R1, that a thing is intelligent to the extent that it's immaterial. I always feel like I'm on just the cusp of understanding the argument, but never quite there. How do you guys explain that to students to get them to, you know, see what's going on?
Aren't you interested?
No. Oh, I mean, no. I don't remember that article. I mean, certainly the process of knowing is abstract in a sense.
I think it's a really fundamental doctrine, that's for sure, in Thomas's understanding of knowledge. And if I remember right, in that article, he actually refers back to question 7, article 1, on God's infinity, where he distinguishes, remember, between two kinds of infinity. One is the infinity of matter without form, right? It's neither this nor that, and it becomes precisely this by way of a form, this sort of thing rather than that, right? And he says that kind of infinity pertains to imperfection. It's an imperfection. It's potency, the potency of matter. But then he says there's another kind of infinity, which is the infinity of form without matter, because matter, when a form is in matter, matter makes it be just the form of this thing and nothing else, right? So the black in the cloth is just the black of the cloth and of nothing else, right? But then he says when a forms in themselves, just by the nature of form, this is why I think the doctrine of form is so important at times, tend to communicate themselves. Their form is just the sort of thing that is self-communicative unless something prevents it. And matter kind of prevents it from doing that. But to the extent that a form is freed from matter, to that extent it can become common to many things, right? And there's different ways it can do that. I mean, the one that we think of, I think, is just the universal. You know, the universal is abstracted from the form abstracted from the matter, and poof, it's common to many things, right? But I think that's not all he's talking about. He's talking about how God is infinite with the infinity of form, and he doesn't mean that God is a universal, right? Because he's not. Right, he's a particular. He's individual. He's not common to many, right? But I think the idea there, and this is how I explain it anyway, that when in an individual mind, for example, or even individual sensation, which is sort of immaterial, you get the form of the thing sensed, or of the thing understood, in the case of the intellect, without the matter, right? That form, even though it's particular. And this is the way he puts it in question 14, right? It's not just the form of the knower. It's also the form of the thing known. Right? It's one form, but it's the form of both. Right? It's the actuality of the knower, and it is the actuality of the thing known, too, at the same time. So I get when I see the black thing, I have the form of black in my sight, but without the matter of black. It's got other matter, but that's why it's only particular. But it's not only my form, the form by which I'm seeing the black, it's also the form of the black thing. It's in me, but it's the form of the black thing, right? As sensible. And that's because it's freed from matter. Does that make any sense?
It does.
Yeah.
I suppose this is a question for Father Legg. So something that was brought up yesterday by Dr. Gorman was a theological issue that he punted to you about simplicity in the Trinity. So I'm especially, we sort of touched on it, but I was wondering if it would be okay to take some of this time to talk about specifically the possibility of real distinction of the persons of the Trinity with the simplicity of the divine nature, especially looking at Aquinas' argument for the existence of God and the simplicity, the uniqueness of God in the Deity Essentia, where things to be distinct. That I think was when we were talking about it was mentioned that in order to be distinct, like you look at what one thing has and what another doesn't. At least nature. So how does that, as simplistic and divine nature, I guess internal, how does that work as much as we can get philosophically?
Well, why don't I throw out a few ideas and then maybe can be corrected or supplemented by others. Maybe Dr. Moreland has something to add here as well. I would say when you're reading the Summa, so this is to jump off a point that Dr. Moreland made just a few minutes ago about the interconnection of the parts of the Summa and how certain parts anticipate other parts. And this is especially the case in the first part of the Summa dealing with the triune God, which where Aquinas is first dealing with what pertains to the divine essence or nature, and then with what pertains to the distinction of persons. So he's not, in fact, treating the same thing. Well, he's treating, in a way, it's treating the same matter by going over it twice, but that's required by the form of our knowing, which cannot hold together at the same time the unity of the divine essence and the distinction among the persons. So Aquinas does not use words, by the way, he doesn't use the word difference or diversity for the persons, but distinction of the persons. So he thinks there's distinctions between persons, but not distinctions that would give you a difference or a diversity of gods. And so because it's, there's actually a very good text on this in the Sentences commentary, where it's a long technical text that hasn't really been translated into English as far as I know. I mean, I've translated a part of it in my book, but not the whole thing. It's long, where he talks exactly about this issue, about how our minds cannot hold these two together, which means every time you talk about the divine essence, you have to hold in the back of your mind the distinction of persons, which is also included in what you're talking about, but that you cannot explicitly talk about in the same sentence. And then, included in your understanding, I think is the way he puts it. And then, likewise, when you're talking about the distinction of the persons, you have to include in your understanding the unity of the divine essence. So it's not talking about, one essence, but three persons, which are like three of the same. I mean, it's not the distinction of persons is not on the same register as the unity of the essence. So that it's not like you're saying one and three in the same sense. Is that clear what I'm saying? So then you would have to talk more, I guess, about this. Like, where do we get this idea of the distinction of the persons? Aquinas really thinks that is you have to start with what God has revealed. And then you explore its intelligibility and show that it's possible to believe.
I'll just add to that. This is working now, right? Yeah. From the perspective of the Trinitarian piece, which is that Thomas inherits all this language, and the language of person, I think, particularly trips us up in particular, and so as we hear it in the modern sense. So that person really, he does the practice that he sets up in question three, which is of kind of emptying out everything that that what we think of about a certain attribute, and then placing it before, sort of kneeling with it. He does the same thing. He continues that practice in question 27 and ensuing, such that person really fundamentally means relation. He kind of dumps out everything that we understand by person other than relation.
Sure.
And that then fits with what he's doing in question 3.
Can I answer that? Mm-hmm. I think that's exactly right. I think you have to pin down where the problem for simplicity comes in. And it's not just that you have one God and three persons, but for this reason, that if the persons are only relations, only, you know, subsistent relations, that's pretty heavy, actually, but they don't, you can understand that they're not sort of components of God, because your relation to another thing is not a component of you, it's not a part, right? but you might still think, well, that may be true, but the persons themselves are kind of composed of the essence and the relation. Okay? So it looks like you still got some kind of, because the relation is constitutive of the person. Okay? But there I think he has a really interesting, I don't remember the reference, but which comes back to the how we have to understand the divine simplicity, right? Which kind of came up yesterday, that if we think of all the divine perfections, we have to see that, you know, God's essay, we can't understand this, but his essay isn't only essay, it's also his goodness, and it's also his wisdom, and those are absolutely identical in him, and they go beyond those concepts. And he says the same thing happens here. The essence is sort of what's absolute in God, and then you have what's relative, the essence of the Father and what's relative in the Father. But he's really beyond both, right? So that it's one and the same thing. Right? There's something sort of beyond the distinction between the absolute and the relative. And that's pretty right. Hard to understand, right? Yeah. But I think that you have to go that far with it.
To add just one more thing, when Aquinas talks about the processions, he starts off by talking about imminent actions. So these are the actions. I mean, the reason he talks about this is he says, well, what diversifies the, or what causes the distinction of the persons cannot be that it's an action that goes from God into something outside of God, because then you would end up with multiple gods or something less. Yeah, sure. I mean, you couldn't have multiple gods. It would be something, it would be a creature. And so he says, well, so it must remain in God. And what can remain in God is the imminent operations of knowing and loving, which remain. So this is why the analogy of the word that Aquinas adapts from Augustine and modifies, sort of deepens, is so important for Aquinas. So if you think about, I mean, I do think that we can begin to grasp this in some way if you just think about, you know, even for ourselves, imagining yourself. You are in a certain way in your mind when you imagine yourself, although imperfectly, because we have an imperfect intellect. A perfect intellect that could imagine itself or could conceive itself would generate a mental word that was absolutely identical to itself in every respect, especially if we're talking about an immaterial intellect that has no body. And the only distinction would be that this word would have come forth from the intellect thinking it. So that's, Aquinas really does take that like in a very strong way and say that's the only sense in which there's any distinction between the Father and the Son. So it's not another God. In fact, it's exactly the same God. The Father and the Son are exactly the same God. And then the same for the Holy Spirit. Yeah, do we want to move away from Trinitarian theology, or is this...
I had a question on that, but Trinitarian theology...
Okay, maybe last question on Trinitarian theology, and then you get back to divine attributes.
The question is whether it's possible or desirable to have a Trinitarian reading of the questions on the divine essence. And I guess the purpose of doing that, and I should probably phrase this in terms of a question, but is it the case that we only fully understand those divine attributes when we understand them in light of the revelation of the Trinity? And does that require us to go back to each of those attributes and to understand them vis-a-vis the relations of the persons? And if it's the case, why doesn't Thomas ever do that? Is this a bad idea?
Well, so I don't think that is the case. That's why I try to be, in the comments that I gave this afternoon, try to say I am not saying that in order to understand 4 to 11, you have to go to 27. I don't think that that's the case. 4 to 11 get deepened, for sure, and in some ways richer, and you're able to see new other dimensions, right?
So I
sound like I'm saying yes? I thought I was saying no. Well, if I'm saying yes, great.
So I'm asking, is it to have the fullest understanding of those
right.
attributes?
Sure. Yes, then yes. Yes, yes, yes. I'm going to say yes three times.
Yeah, Frater Irwin.
ask Professor a couple questions about the infinity of the world.
Sure.
Can you speak a little louder?
Sure. So, one, just a Thomas interpreting Aristotle question, and then second, a more kind of substantive question. So, I was curious about the presentation of Aristotle as basically arguing for the infinitivist conclusion, as though Aristotle thought that were necessary, and especially curious about your understanding, Thomas's understanding of Aristotle on that, and in the sections where Thomas talks about what Aristotle actually believed about that, is what's Thomas up to? Because it seems not to match up with that thesis that Aristotle is some kind of strong infinitivist. And an easy case of that, though, they're all over the commentaries on the physics and the De Coelo and other things as well, but an easy case of that is question 46, article 1, which we had on our handout there. The paragraph right after that, still in the corpus of article 1, he says, of course, Aristotle is not making this argument absolutely, but relatively, simply attacking in a kind of reductio ad absurdum way other pre-Socratics who held this impossible idea about time independent of matter, time is not an affectation of matter, where Thomas's view of Aristotle seems to be that Aristotle thought you couldn't prove that it had to be this way, but that if you took these people's assumed starting points, then you could do that. And certainly it's true for Aristotle that naturally that's all we can assume and know, but that we can know with certainty.
Can we do that one first before? I'll probably have less to say about this, but first of all, I'm aware that, you know, there are places where Thomas says, well, I think Aristotle's just going dialectically here or something like that. And I'll admit, I'm not quite sure what to make of that. But also, you know, there was I didn't end up using it. There's a place in the metaphysics somewhere where, you know, Aristotle kind of hinges his whole anti-Platonist thing on the infinity of the world, right? He says, you know, I think it goes exactly, you know, Plato wasn't far from wrong when he posited separated forms, but I don't have to do that because man has come from man for all eternity. So I, you know, I'm not an interpreter of Aristotle, but my hunch is he's pretty serious about an infinite world, and he thinks he's demonstrated it. But I'm aware of those passages that you mentioned where Thomas does seem to think, in some cases, Aristotle's proceeding dialectically there. But my view is that Aristotle's serious about this, right? Father, do you?
Yeah, I agree with that. And it's, if I remember right, and this goes back, I haven't studied this in a while, but at least Father Weisheitel argued that there are those texts that he says, kind of what you say, and that's even the Summa, that he's being dialectical, he's giving us, that the people who try to prove that the world had a beginning aren't giving good arguments and stuff. But his final word is more is the commentary on the physics that's later, and there he finally just says, "No, Aristotle thinks he's proved that the world is eternal, and he's wrong." Right? That's his final view.
I don't know. Maybe we're thinking of different texts in the physics, but I thought in the physics, Thomas's point was just to say, speaking as a philosopher, he has to say this. But it's the equivalent of saying, naturally speaking, any fully grown tree you see had to come from an acorn. Speaking as a philosopher, you have to say that there's a natural necessity there. But if there were a God working to do this outside of what would be...
Oh, I don't find it saying that, yeah.
I thought that was Thomas's view.
I don't think so.
Dr. Carl, you want to jump in on this point?
Okay, yeah,
please.
Just speak loudly.
Okay, yeah, so in the commentary on the physics, I mean, in the physics itself, Aristotle gives two arguments appealing to definitions from earlier in the physics. One is appealing to the definition of motion, the other is appealing to the definition of time. I agree with Father Brock that I think Thomas is clearly taking Aristotle as purporting to demonstrate the eternity of motion, providing two demonstrations, but his reaction to the two is different. I think on the handout, there was a snippet from Thomas Christian, right, of the argument from the definition of time, right? And that's the one that St. Thomas says is just a bad argument,
yeah.
Right? Because if the moment is an analogy compared to the point, right, then it's only true that every moment is a middle between past and future if you're assuming that every point is like on an infinite line, right? But there are points that begin line, arguments, right? And they're, well, okay. So that's the argument that he says that's just a bad argument. But the argument from the definition of motion, he says it is a demonstration. It's just not a demonstration of what Aristotle thinks that it demonstrates. Aristotle thinks that it serves to demonstrate the eternity of motion, but all it actually serves to demonstrate is that in order for generation, substantial generation, to occur, there must have been prior motion. And then in the commentary on the physics, he says, and so this in fact amounts to a demonstration that there must be a distinction between generation and creation.
Yeah.
So just as far as how I remember him reading Aristotle's argument,
I think that's right.
And then the substantive question, and I was looking for a text for this, and I'm afraid I haven't been able to find it. Someone else may know it. But I was thinking that with the infinite magnitude business, I've definitely heard before, and this makes sense of the apparent wavering that Thomas does back and forth in those different texts we saw this morning, that the problem with infinite magnitude is a problem of number in the sense of the countability of bodies of material things. Strictly speaking, or nitically speaking, there's not a number of angels at all in that sense. And therefore, this problem of infinity, every time Thomas says that's impossible, he's talking about physical quantity or forms informing physical matter. And if you look at the reasons for that, I do have that in question 7, obviously, of the prima pars and elsewhere, but talking about infinity, all of the reasons seem like they wouldn't apply if you weren't talking about material things. So in the question of Aristotle at least implicitly believing in an infinity of souls, infinity there is being used in such a way that it doesn't raise those problems, and seems like that's a possible Thomistic answer to Bonaventure's argument. But I wish I had a text for that, and I don't, so I was curious.
I think we could just change the example easily enough. You know, I mean, let's suppose for every being that there's been, God makes a mark on a hash mark on a chalkboard or something, and he keeps making infinitely many chalkboards. You'd have infinitely many chalk marks by the time we got to this point.
I mean, no, that's true. But sorry, I'm keeping the example because I think the point of the example is that that's actually the case. There really are infinite,
right,
quote, souls, and that's the thrust of the argument.
Yeah.
It's not just an example to illustrate. That's actually
right. What
the infinity is proved from.
Right.
Whereas that would be true if you had God making a physical check mark every time,
right,
then you really would have this problem. The point is, we don't have this problem because that's not the case. Whereas
but as long as Aquinas' position entails this sort of counter possibility, you know, even if there's nothing that commits him to being an actual infinite, if his position entails that there could be an actual infinite, then all the problems are going to arise that are brought up.
Yeah, I don't think he thinks there could be an actual infinite.
Yeah.
But I don't think Aristotle thinks there could be an actual infinite in that sense either.
Right.
That's why.
Yeah, I mean, the idea being that even a per accidens regress would itself entail some kind of actual infinite. That's the worry, right?
My takeaway from this is that Frater Urban saying angels cannot be numbered means it's a useless question to ask how many angels can dance in the head of a pin.
But that isn't true. I don't think that's true.
Can I make a point that I... not in response to the brother, but something I wanted to do in the paper that I just couldn't squeeze in, that's actually relevant to the conference, unlike my paper. Okay, so one of the interesting things that I found out in looking into this is Bonaventure's worries with Aquinas are very much theological. Right? I found a passage where Bonaventure says, look, like if we go with this eternity of the world stuff, we say it's even possible. What comes of providence then? Because he says basically if the forms aren't separated in God's mind, then you've got nature down here ticking on its own, you know, one generation passing form to another, and there's no need for any kind of intervention. In Bonaventure's view, we lose providence then, that there's no sense in which God is actually informing nature in any kind of independent act. And this is big, and it was over my head, and that's why I didn't claim in the paper. It seems to me that for maybe part of what Thomas's reply to the whole drama is this participation metaphysic, right? Where we need this sort of this Platonic synthesis here, where no, even though we don't think of forms as separated in the way a Platonist would, there's still a need for God's or nature's constant participation in that Platonic sense in God's mind. Does that make sense? And so it seems to me actually that what the stakes were in the Middle Ages in this debate were very much about God's attributes and not, you know, in what we tend to see them as. So.
Yes?
I had a question for Dr. Morland. You quoted Karl Barth at one point. I don't know how familiar you are with his work. I myself only know Bits and Spades. But I'm wondering if your suggestion that the divine attributes are ultimately Christologically shaped, especially divine goodness, then one result might be that the angelic doctrine and the Swiss Protestants are somewhat closer to one another than is commonly thought. On the one hand, we don't want to say creation is necessary. On the other hand, we could say, you know, following Dionysus is what Aquinas says, that it belongs to the highest good to defuse itself. I think Aquinas says, well, here I'm going to quote the Tertius Pius' first question. This diffusion is achieved by, God uniting himself to humanity. Would Aquinas agree with Barth that the God's identity is directed at the election of creation in Jesus Christ?
Right, so I knew it was a risk when I quoted Barth. I didn't mean to, again, in that maybe I should have just said something right after I said that quote. That I didn't. I certainly, by citing Barth, because I do think it's a beautiful and true passage, the one that I did from 2:1, the Church Dogmatics. I didn't mean to fully align Barth and Aquinas on their Trinitarian theologies, like by any stretch. And I think Barth has some limitations that Aquinas doesn't, that I think you've just articulated.
Maria in the back.
Honestly, I'm sure that there's an answer to that question, but I'd have to go back to the text and read them. It's a very good question. Does anyone else have an answer to that question? Good.
I have a thought about the text response, but this is a discussion several we were having last night. If we said that somehow Christ died by virtue of his humanity, right, and his humanity had been conjoined to divine nature through the Logos, then if we somehow could imagine, also bearing in mind that he has a human soul, that's not the source of the persona as it would be for any other human being, then it seems like you could imagine that if on the cross his human nature, soul and body, was somehow removed from its beatitude and that by virtue of being connected to the divine nature through the Logos, that was somehow removed from that, it would no longer experience beatitude, totally deprived and experience sort of, in a certain figuratively, sort of a maximal privation of what it had in the beatitude through the Son, such that Christ, while human, would experience a privation that was sort of beyond description, because it would be the deprivation of beatitude, which none of us have on this side of the grave. So,
does that require separation?
Well, I think you have to speak in some sense that human nature was separated from the divine persona.
If I can just jump in here very briefly before we go very deeply into a very deep theological subject. What you're describing is actually quite similar to the position taken by, say, Hans-Urs von Balthasar, and I think Karl Barth, and others, who posit a kind of total... So when they talk about the cry of dereliction of Christ from the cross, they posit a kind of total abandonment of the Son by the Father so that the Son experiences damnation even. So that he goes all the way to that point, and that's how they would understand this text about Christ becoming sin. Aquinas has a very different account of that, and he would absolutely not agree with the idea that Jesus empties himself to the point of even emptying himself of his divinity or of the beatific vision and so forth. So Aquinas actually has to then account for how is it possible for Jesus to suffer on the cross with the beatific vision and so forth. So there's a lot more to be said on that point, but I don't want to go too deep into this. I mean, I think, hands are vigorously going up. Different topic. Yeah, I think we should move to different. Yeah.
I feel like the last response that Dr. Madden gave actually opened up some interesting things and perhaps a way even to connect Father Brock's two talks with one another. But
hell, I know.
That's all a matter of speculation. But I wanted to just start with this and say, speaking of the divine attributes we haven't covered, I was happy to hear you bring up providence. What do you think, if there's anything about the fifth way that might tell us something about providence as an attribute? Or at least providence insofar as it's a preamble.
Go ahead. You know, I think, and Father, you know, brought this up, is when we, a lot of times I think, in the popular imagination, there's a tendency to think of... Is it working?
Yeah.
I think in the popular imagination, there's a tendency to think of providence, you know, in the divine watchmaker model, where God winds up, there's a program that the universe is going to run, and God just sort of sets it spinning.
Yeah.
With the fifth way... At least the way I read the fifth way. Now, this means every time something dumb in the universe is acting, God's thinking for it, right? I mean, God's involvement with the universe is not just efficient causally, but intelligently intimate with every single event, right, going on, you know, at all the down to the elements, right? Even, I mean, and I actually think the interesting way to think about the fifth way is at the level of the elements, right? Because then, but anyway, and so I think the And you know he brings up this argument, much like the fifth way. I know in De Veritate and then later in the Summa, under the argument for providence.
Yes,
right? Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah.
And so I think it's a very it once you understand the fifth way, that kind of divine watchmaker, intelligent design, I think truncated view of providence has been squeezed out.
In the text that I read, that I mentioned in book two of the commentary on the physics, he calls it a proof of divine providence. He calls it that. He doesn't say governance. He says providence. Right? But I think this is absolutely right. I think this is fundamental. It's connected with the what Professor Gorman said, that God operates in every nature. He applies everything to its activity. Right? The natural things, we have to see God as acting now, giving the inclination to fall or to whatever, to the things, and he says there he not only conserves them in being but also applies them to the activity. Now I would want to make a distinction there with regard to the activity of the human will, but that leads directly to Molinism and all kinds of things. So I'm not going to go there.
Can I suggest that we go with a question? I know that there are a few hands up from people who've asked many questions. We have a bunch of students here who've not yet asked a question. So are there students who haven't asked a question who want to pose one? At least start thinking about it, and we'll come to you next, and I'll go to Dr. Gorman. You had.
I was just curious if anybody had anything special to say about the order in which Aquinas treats the attributes. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of obvious why. Well, okay, so he's going to do the existence of God first. I get that, right? Now, maybe simplicity should come next. I sort of get that. He could, as far as I can tell by the argumentation, go right from that to divine unity. But somebody put it out, it's 11, right? So he holds off for a long time before he tells you that there's only one. Why does he wait so long? And then why is there that interlude on naming and stuff, and then more attributes after? So, and now, you know, if you take the spider web thing to the max, which I don't think Dr. Morland is actually suggesting, if you take it super to the max, it doesn't matter at all, right? You can just mix them all up. I'm sure, I know that's not what you were saying. But I don't want to be, like, too crazy with this question, but why are they in the order that they're in?
Brian?
I was just looking. so this was Michael knows well. This is the topic of my dissertation.
This sounds like a setup. This is.
So I think yesterday at one point someone said that you know there's things that Thomas will say that sometimes you know the best translation might just be it's complicated, and that's what I would say here. So I mean, really the fruit of the work in the dissertation. I mean, I looked at it was on the Contradictiles.
It was on the Contradictiles and the Compendium Theologiae and the Summa Theologiae. And the answer in the end was that it's complicated, and I was hoping to find like one, you know, rationale, like one beautiful plan, you know, that sort of unfolds. And that's not what I found. What I found were reasons, you know, for why it proceeded in this order. What I found were differences, important differences between the Contradictiles and the Summa Theologiae. So just give one example of that. In the Contradictiles, he's much more indebted to Aristotle. Which Aristotle presents things, because for Aristotle, to come back to the eternity of the world, the eternity of the world and of motion and the eternity of the first mover all go hand in hand, and everything that Aristotle has to say about his first and highest principle is premised on eternity. And Thomas, I mean, if eternity is he does immutability eternity, right? Eternity, he says we've already proven immutability in chapter 13, so he begins with eternity in chapter 15 of the book one of the Contradictiles. So that shifted away. So, you know, one reason why the orders are different is because I think he's moved away from that way of being dependent on Aristotle. The Compendium Theologiae is nice, because there I think there's a little bit more of a rationale for what he does and the order in which he does it, because I think it's much more just propedeutic for the Trinitarian theology. There's a lot of divine attributes he doesn't treat, and he really just treats the things that he has to treat in order to be able to talk intelligently about the Trinity. Okay, I don't want to like repeat my dissertation. The short answer is that it's really complicated. But I do think, you know, along the way there are good pedagogy, especially in the Summa Theologiae. I think it is primarily motivated by just the order of learning. There are good reasons for why he makes the transition from one to the next. So why does he do perfection after simplicity? He tells us in the prologue, right? He says it's because, and this is a really good reason for beginners especially, he says that usually simple things are less perfect. So I've just told you that God is the simplest thing. And a student might think, oh, God is like the elements. He's like the least perfect thing. So he has to say, no, actually God is maximally perfect, including all the perfections of creatures. And then you might think, oh, well, perfect things, they're like whole and complete, right? And I think that's why infinity comes next, is because usually when you think of what's whole or complete, you're thinking of, you know, wholeness or completeness in terms of finitude. You know, it's like, you know, none of the pieces of the pie are missing, right? So I think that's why infinity comes next. And then the general, one of the things that I said the other day, I mean, the general movement through the first 11 questions, I think there's this alternation between the negative and the affirmative. I do think that's an important. The negative is kind of leading the way until you can get to the point where you've said enough to be able to reason through all the positive attributes that are in questions 14 to 26. I'll stop. I'll just say this. What I talked about the other day, the stuff about he who is, there not being any one notion, you know, that radically unifies knowledge of God in this life. That was where I ended up after trying to figure out what was the fundamental sort of rationale and the fundamental source, and the ultimate conclusion was that there isn't any one thing.
You have a new questioner?
This is a question for Dr. Madden. When you were giving a talk on infinite and the finite world, I couldn't help but think about modern theories of the beginning of the world, you know, such as the Big Bang Theory and things like that, and I was wondering if you've thought about these ideas in relation to the modern theories about the beginning of the world. And I was especially curious because there are some Catholics who assert that we can know by reason that there was a definitive beginning of the world, and they try to use those arguments to say, oh, well, there's a creator and there's a God, etc., etc., against the atheists. So I was just wondering if you could comment on that.
You know, I think those considerations just come down to what we mean by world. Okay, so you know, when we think about the evidence for the Big Bang, you know, we've got evidence to think that, yeah, this round of ordered motion is finite, and we can trace it back to some absolute beginning. But this is why I actually included stuff in the paper. Well, that doesn't mean there wasn't some long, maybe infinite history of either prior Big Bangs or just, you know, unstructured, chaotic matter. Do you see what I mean? So I don't think anything has been, in the sense that a world is being used in the medieval debate, anything's been proven one way or another. Does that make sense? And so, yeah, when we say, you know, the Big Bang shows the world is finite in duration, well, what we mean there is not necessarily that, you know, finite being is limited in its duration, right? We just mean that this particular set of laws of nature that we're operating under right now seem to be finite in its duration. And maybe there have been other iterations of laws of nature, or maybe there was a pre-law state, you know, prior to time, or all these other hypotheses that are entertained, right? So I think the current scientific, as far as I understand it, situation is just as unsettled as it was in Thomas's time, maybe more so.
Yeah, Rebecca?
I have a question for Dr. Moreland. You mentioned, I found it really compelling, that reading Thomas is like getting to know a person, and that has to do with the complexity of the web. And it made me reflect that when I get to know a person, I become friends with person, it's fairly multidimensional in a way that when I read philosophers, it doesn't always have all of the same dimensions. I was wondering if you have anything to say or any advice about the dispositions as a student of Thomas you can have in order to get to know him as a person and that, you know, that two-way.
This might freak out Dr. Gorman a little bit, because this is 25 years ago. I don't know if you remember this, but we were in a doctoral colloquium together, and I was really worked up about a Trinitarian question. I can't remember what we were reading, but I remember being really wildly worked up, and I was having trouble understanding this text, and Dr. Gorman said to me, "How's your moral life?" And I looked at him, I was like, what? Excuse me, what are you talking about? And I was really put off by that that question, I will say, at the time. But,
and you've clearly carried this for 25
years. No, wait, hold on. But in retrospect, that conversation did stay with me, not in the sort of grudgy kind of way, but in the there was a point kind of way. I don't know if there was a point at that moment, but the larger point of the process of reading the Summa is a process in asceticism and sanctification and deification, that as you become a better person, you become a better reader of Thomas. It's just a fact. And I don't say that as somebody who's become a really terrific person, but I see that as somebody who has been changed by the Summa. And I think in the process of rereading, and it's not just about the Summa, it can be, certainly it's happened to me with the Nicomachean Ethics too. It certainly happened to me with the Confessions, which I hated the first time around, but because I didn't have ears to hear, right? So, and I don't think that it's particular to theological texts that this process takes place. I think it happened as well, definitely with philosophical texts, with Plato's Republic, of course. And I think you find that in the process of rereading, like in the process of getting to know a friend, the multidimensional aspect does take hold.
Yeah, in the back.
So my question follows on that one. It's about the divine science. So I'm wondering whether by divine science Aquinas means that in some sense you need the theological virtues.
So I think the only one who totally grasps divine science is God, and the blessed as they understand God, right? So it's God who knows God's self, and it's the blessed know God. And the rest of us are trying to reach up to that. And there, we reach up to that by faith, but we also reach up to that by natural reason. And I think there's an integrity to reaching up to that by natural reason that is in play for Thomas. And so I don't think I would agree with what you're insinuating. And yet, the reaching up to the divine science through kind of philosophical arguments or natural theology is certainly limited. Right, it's certainly stammering. But again, like I said in the paper, it is not like once you have faith, you don't stammer. It is absolutely true to the structure of the human person that we know by hearing, whether that's by natural reason or by faith.
John, I know you've asked a question before, but I'm happy to call on you because your questions are good.
So I want to ask a little more about that. We talked about it a little bit earlier about the importance of the faith. So we've been talking about the divine attributes, and so I was thinking, well, if we can prove with reason that the world is not eternally extended, whatever term we want to use, that things have always been around. Seem like that would then become a scientifically knowable fact and demonstrable by reason, and therefore it should seem to be clear in the preamble of DNA. So what would be lost or what is the importance of maintaining that we cannot be sure that it can be only known day to day for Aquinas? Would it really matter to his theology?
Yeah, this probably gets over my historical pay grade as to what's, you know, motivating him, but I'll take a stab at it. I mean, on the one hand, no one's accusing the Augustinians who thought the world was finite in duration of some kind of heresy, of operating contrary to the faith, right? Whereas, if I understand it right, everybody's accusing the Aristotelians who thought the world was infinite in duration of some kind of heresy, okay? So it seems to me that for Thomas, the theological motive is only going in one way. He wants to save Aristotelianism as something that's theologically acceptable. Okay, so I don't know that anything really rides on it for him theologically to say that the world cannot be demonstrated as finite, but to just sort of kind of rehabilitate Aristotelianism as acceptable, for Catholics to dabble in. Does that make sense? But if there's a historical point I'm missing here, I'm happy to be corrected on that.
I think maybe we should just kind of draw things to a close. I see a few hands here. Maybe these will just be the last questions, and then Mariana.
I was wondering, in Eastern Orthodox tradition, there's a tendency to see contemplation and theology as being pretty much synonymous, which is one reason why often Scholasticism is seen with a little bit of skepticism. And my question is, do you see, if the Summa is a spiritual exercise, do you see it as a starting point for contemplation or a form of contemplation in itself, or perhaps both?
Right, so that's a great question. So Torrell is great on this with when he talks about speculare, you know, whether in that first question, whether sacra doctrina is more speculative or practical, and he points out that, you know, speculare really fundamentally means contemplation, that it doesn't, we understand it as speculative, as intellectual and sort of unrooted from the contemplative. But that question, that article really asks whether Sacra Doctrina is more contemplative or practical. And he says, well, mostly contemplative, but not just contemplative. So I think that some of the characterizations of Thomas on this, I think, miss the mark. And so I lost my train of thought.
Brother Isidore?
That's good.
I had a question for Dr. Madden about, I was wondering, you mentioned the response to the many souls argument by the God could have just at some point within this infinite world made that. I was wondering why you didn't think that was sufficient to remove the demonstrative force of the infinite souls argument. It just seems to me that, like, that kind of, if there's that possibility, then it's no longer entirely demonstrative. So you wouldn't necessarily have to go to the denying the premise of an infinite multiplicity too. So I was wondering why you chose to make that move.
Because it doesn't, you're pointing out that, well, it just maybe just turned out that God didn't do that, that he started creating humans later in the process. Whatever later in an infinite process means, I worry about that. But,
is that it? Yeah, sorry, I'll take care of it.
Thank you. So, Thomas says, he deflects it by saying, well, God might have just brought humans into the picture later, and fine, but it still seems like he's committed to, if God had wanted to, he could have always been creating humans, and so then, if that's the case, then if God had wanted to, he could have created at this point now, a completed multitude of human souls, right? And if that's the case, then it would seem he's committed to the possibility of what he has claimed earlier to be an impossibility. And so I think just by saying, well, there's no reason to think there's an actual infinity of human souls right now because God didn't have to do it that way. That's fine, but it misses the point. The point is it seems that Thomas has committed himself to the claim that there could have been one, which is contrary to what he's claimed to have demonstrated.
You get the last question.
Oh, he's just a quick follow-up on that. So how do you see the commitment going from he could have created an infinite universe? How is that entailing the commitment to it's possible that he would have created an infinite number of souls? Because,
sure.
It seems like
if
he could have created an infinite universe, it doesn't necessarily entail he could have created an infinite number of immaterial souls, because, as he pointed out elsewhere, it's logically impossible to do that. So he's committed to saying there's an infinite universe of some sort of type, but obviously one that's not logically impossible.
Right. There seems to be no reason to think, though, that God, if he could have made a universe infinite in duration, couldn't have then, as an infinite subset even of that infinity, have brought along humans for that long of the ride, too. In which case, he would then have to say, yeah, then it's possible that there's an infinite number of souls.
Well, this brings us to the conclusion of the actively philosophical program. Let's thank our panel for their contributions.